Welcome to the debut full episode of the Legal Moves Podcast. My name is Zachary Strebeck. I'm a California game lawyer and a blogger. And with me today on the first inaugural episode are two great guests from the board game industry. First, we have Jamie Stegmeier.
Hi, Zach. My name is Jamie Stegmeier. I run a board game company called Stonemeyer Games. I've run a few Kickstarter campaigns, and I write a lot about Kickstarter on my blog at KickstarterLessons.com.
All right. Welcome, Jamie. My second guest is Andrew Federspiel.
Hey, guys. My name is Andrew, and I am founder of Knapsack Games. We make like casual and mid-core board games. And we had a game on Kickstarter last year, which is called Knee Jerk. It's a party game, and we successfully funded that. And now, right now, we have Apotheca, the Secret Potion Society, which is a strategy game on Kickstarter, and it's actually running until July 9th. So
awesome. Well, it's great to have both of you. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about business and legal issues in the game industry. While you guys are both board game designers, over time we'll be featuring video game, mobile game, even I have a reality-based game developer who does sort of spy games in the middle of San Francisco. So
cool.
it'll be an interesting podcast. So we'll also have some business people from the industry coming on in the next month or so. Cool. So each show we'll start off with some game industry news, then we'll answer some questions from the audience. In this episode, I've taken some from the Dice Tower Guild on Board Game Geek. And last, we have a specific topic each week that we'll discuss. So today's topic is raising money for your game on Kickstarter. So hopefully the listeners stick around for that. Let's get to the news first. So the first story I picked was a new Kickstarter that was announced by Sony at their E3 press conference for a game called Shenmue 3. And I don't know if you guys are following the board or the video game industry, or if you care about Shenmue at all. This is a game that I never played, but it's a pretty big deal. I mean, they had a $2 million goal, and they reached it within hours. It was ridiculously fast. So, do you guys know anything about this one?
I definitely stay in the loop because I used to be in the video game industry doing like mobile and social stuff, and I have friends that work in AAA games and. I mean, just as when I was younger, like I remember a ton of people were into Shenmue and like always look back on it with, they just really cared about it, right? So, I mean, it makes sense that it's big. I've also noticed, though, that the campaign it really slowed down after the first 2 days, which is kind of typical for any Kickstarter campaign. But for this one, it seemed, it just really lost all its momentum.
Well, I think the reason there's been some negative press around the funding of the game and the fact that Sony, a representative from Sony, announced the Kickstarter in their E3 press conference. I think it's drawn some ire from game industry fans. So it was unclear in the beginning who was, so there was a $2 million Kickstarter, but that's definitely not enough to make a game. I mean, I think I've read that they spent $70 million on the first game. So to think that you can make basically a third iteration of the game for only $2 million, I think a lot of fans were skeptical. And so there were questions about, why is Sony advertising this Kickstarter? Why aren't they funding it themselves, first of all? And then, is there some sort of funding that we don't know about? So I think, and even I posted a link, and I'll post it in the show notes that go along with this. They came out and clarified the funding situation, but they didn't really clarify it because the terms are all confidential. So they basically just said that Sony and then another company are helping with the funding and the marketing afterwards. But, well, and that was one of the questions. So, they say that because of all that funding, they'll be able to use all of the money for making the game. Shouldn't they have used all the money for making the game in the first place? I mean, if you have a distinct number of people that are going to get the game, you don't technically need to do any marketing beyond that, right? At least as far as a traditional Kickstarter is concerned. Obviously for this, they want to sell a lot more afterwards, but...
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's almost like they don't need the money, but at the same time, like Shenmue, they haven't had a Shenmue game out in a very long time, and they need to just gauge what the popularity is of it.
Sure.
And so it's almost like the Kickstarter is just sort of taking the temperature of the room and seeing if people are actually going to buy it. And, hey, the money is good, too, and we'll use that in other ways. But so that's one way to look at it. It is weird that it's Sony doing it. But, for smaller Kickstarters, I do feel like for, I guess I'll just speak to my own experience, like using some of that money to cover the cost for marketing seemed totally reasonable because your Kickstarter backers wouldn't know about the game unless you used some of the money for marketing, right? So it's kind of like a catch-22. Like, you have to be able to use some of it for that, but what were we going to say?
Well, in those situations, they haven't gotten the Kickstarter money yet, so you sort of have to use your own money to do any marketing, I would imagine, right?
Right. Yeah, in this case, it's very different because they're such a mammoth entity, mm-hmm. Sony. Yeah. It's not like me spending a couple hundred dollars on a review or something like that.
Well, and I don't think they're doing anything wrong as far as like the terms of Kickstarter go, but it just seems like a weird moral gray area where, you know, I don't know. I always feel weird about the using Kickstarter to gauge. I mean, it makes sense to gauge the temperature of the room, as you said, but then and then promising more funds afterwards. But, you know, in a situation like with Star Citizen, you know, where they've raised a ton of money after their original crowdfunding campaign, but what if they didn't, right? What if they were stuck with just that original funding? Could they have made the game that they were promising without all that external funding? I guess that's the question, you know. Should it be self-contained, or should you be able to ethically, you know, need more funding? What if that funding falls through, or what if there's some other problem? Jamie, do you have any opinion on this?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, especially to that last point, I've seen campaigns in the past that go back to backers and say, hey, look, we miscalculated this, we need more money. And that generally does not go over well at all. But I think the Star Citizen campaign and Shenmue, if they're upfront about the, at least even vague terms about the overall cost of the game, and they're saying, you know, either A, we have this covered and we're using this money to, I guess, kickstart it or jumpstart it, that's one thing. Or if they said upfront, like, I don't know, I don't think I've ever seen a campaign actually do this, but to say, hey, our funding goal is 2 million, but we actually need 5 million.
Right.
You could say that. I just think you have to communicate that upfront if you're going to communicate it at all, because no one wants you to come back to backers afterward and say, we need more money now, right, even though we've already funded.
Okay. I don't know. It just, yeah, it's one of those things where I wish they would be more open. And I think that's where a lot of the negative press and the sort of, you know, stalling out, you know, in the beginning, people were expecting it to go up to $10 million, but now it looks like it might hit five, which is a lot of money. You know, that's a huge amount of money for Kickstarter, but to make a full Shenmue style game, maybe that's not enough. So we'll see. I don't know. This is one of those things where the real story will come out in a few years, and we'll see actually what ends up getting shipped. So, okay. Second story. This might not interest you guys too much, but Apple, there was a story on the BBC about Apple Computer. I guess they're releasing a new news app with iOS 9, and they sent out an email to a bunch of publications basically saying, hey, we're going to pull your RSS feeds, and we're going to use your stories in this news app. And and you're also agreeing to these terms of service for the use of them. Well, basically, you had to opt out if you didn't agree. And some of the terms were, you know, things that maybe people don't want to agree to. Like, there's an indemnity clause where if Apple gets sued over something that was wrong with the story, then the actual publisher would have to indemnify them or basically defend them in a lawsuit. So the problem, you know, and people were angry, or the publishers were angry, because they were basically getting sucked into this contract when they wouldn't normally have agreed to it. So I guess, you know, I wrote a blog post. It's on my site. I'll post the link in my show notes. But this is one of those things where it's like a misunderstanding of how contracts work, and how generally you can't agree to a contract through silence unless you're making it clear that your silence is an agreement. Like, you say, well, if I don't reply to this, then consider it agreed or something like that. But I remember, Jamie, I had written a Kickstarter lessons post on your blog about the Orcfather Kickstarter campaign. Do you remember that? Where they sort of had a contract in the rules or the risk and rewards section.
And right. Yeah. They had, a little warning that said something like, that I think they said, like, unexpected things happen, and by backing the project, you are understanding that unexpected things happen. Was that it?
It was something like that, where you were basically agreeing that, you know, yes, you may not get your reward. But again, and like I pointed out in that post, you know, that's missing one of the three main elements of a contract that's binding is, you know, acceptance of the contract. So you need some sort of affirmative action usually. So I just thought that was an interesting one. Something to avoid if you're doing any kind of contract. If you're running a mobile app or doing something like that, you can't just assume that everyone's going to agree to your contract. You have to generally get some sort of, you know, usually it's clicking a checkbox and saying, I agree, something like that. It doesn't have to be a lot because nobody reads these things anyway. But you still, if there's a problem later and you get sued, you need to be able to show that. That's all.
Right.
Let me ask you this, Zach. Oh, sorry, Andrew, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like you said before, Zach, that this is kind of a misunderstanding of contract law. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that Apple knew what they were getting into. They can afford to take the risk because they have such a generally good reputation. I mean, except for, you know, all their China manufacturing stuff. Exactly. But like they have that, and they have like insane cash reserves. So if they take a risk once in a while, I think it's not so bad. But it definitely is good for the rest of us that need to know about, you know, things like, you know, taking those risks. But well, what were you going to say, Jamie?
Let me just reply to that. Even with all their lawyers, I mean, they just I think the appeals court just handed down a ruling today that yes, they were involved in a price fixing scheme for the ebooks. So with all the lawyers in the world, you still kind of push the boundaries. And I guess it's one of those, you know, make the mistake and ask for forgiveness later type of deals. You know, even Apple's lawyers can't escape that. So, Jamie, what were you going to say?
Well, the example I was going to bring up, and Andrew, you'll soon deal with this when you send out your backer surveys, is that on a few projects ago on my Between Two Cities project, on the survey, I had a question that said, can write yes if the address that you've put into Kickstarter for delivering Between Two Cities is an address where someone can receive the package during the day. Mm-hmm. The idea being that in the past, I've had backers ship to like a home address and the package has gotten stolen, or maybe the shipping company says that it's been delivered, but no one actually received it. And then I kind of, as the creator, I end up being accountable and having to send them an extra game, which is not a problem when it's like a smaller game. But for a $90 collector's edition, that adds up. And that wasn't even the case on Between Two Cities. It was like a $39 game. But I put that question on there, and there was – people did not like it. And I'm mentioning it here because I'm wondering if you would count that as a valid contract that they're opting into at that point?
Not to speak to your specific situation, but I mean generally if you know you – well, you're asking a question and there's – that's an interesting one. I would have to think about that. It certainly seems like it's the type of thing that creates at least a binding agreement there. You know, they're saying this is the address that you should send it to. What exactly was the complaint that they were having? They didn't want to commit to that address being one where they could receive the package?
Yeah, people had a hard time picturing like where they would be in 6 months.
Right.
And they kind of felt like I was passing off accountability on them. Whereas I was watching out for both of us because I want them to get their game just as much as I don't want to have to send them two games. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a mutually beneficial thing for them to ship it. And the end result was kind of good. It made people more aware of how important that shipping address is. But for the when I did my next campaign, I did not put that question on there just because it didn't go over very well. Andrew, did you do anything like that in your first campaign or did you have that experience where?
No, I didn't do that kind of thing. I mean, it was... I mean, in your case, I do wonder if they would have reacted more positively if it was just closer to the ship date rather than being so far out.
Yeah.
Because then they knew it was coming. They didn't have to think that far in advance. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I'll be home. I'll be there in a month or whatever because my situation won't have changed that much. But yeah, for me, I didn't do that sort of thing. I honestly didn't think to, but it was mostly just because Knee Jerk was a one deck in a tuck box game. So the package was very small and it wasn't like a box thing that... that people would steal, I guess. But
yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's go to our third story. The FTC settled with, if you remember, the creator of The Doom That Came to Atlantic City, if you remember that Kickstarter, was sort of a big deal. You know, they had raised $112,000, something around that. And it came out that, you know, the creator, well, it was, there was a creator who created the project, but he had contracted with some artists and game designers. So I don't think the creator was the one actually designing the game. But, it, you know, after about a year and a half, they came out and said that, no, we can't ship the game. You know, basically the money was gone. Everything was gone. And it came out that, you know, the guy had used it to start a company, to move to Oregon, and there were some other things. And so the FTC has finally come to a settlement with him. But, I mean, this is it's funny because, yes, he owes the $112,000 because there's a judgment, but they basically stipulate that, yes, he can't pay it, so it's suspended. He doesn't have to do it. And then, yeah, I think he's not allowed to advertise products or do a Kickstarter. There's some other stipulations in the settlement agreement. But, you know, my question for you guys is, in this situation, was justice served? You know, has anyone won? I mean, all the money's gone. Yes, Cryptozoic afterwards, I think, published the game and then delivered it to all the backers. I think, you know, so I don't know if Cryptozoic lost out. I would imagine they didn't get any money for that. So that's good of them. They didn't give all the miniatures and other things that were promised to the higher backer levels, though. So, you know, now there's no money. You know, maybe the reputation of Kickstarter is a little bit tarnished. This is the kind of thing that brings negative press. And then people, you know, the people who have already kind of made up their minds about Kickstarter being a big risk, they can all point to it and say, hey, yeah, see? I mean, what are you guys' opinions on this, Andrew?
In terms of justice served, no way. I mean, it's right. He didn't have to do anything. Nothing actually happened. He still got to use the money for everything that he wanted to. Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I do feel like there should have been, maybe you can speak more to this point, but just some kind of thing where he has to, you know, try and make savings and try and owe some money to someone for something.
Right. Well, I think if they find out that he's lied about his financial situation or something like that, they can come back after him. But I mean, really, is anyone going to be following up on that? And I mean, $112,000 seems like a lot to us, but to the FTC, you know, I'm sure it's very little. It's a drop.
Right. There's much bigger fish to fry. Yeah.
So I'm not sure that, you know, they're going to be checking on the guy's finances over and over again.
I almost wonder if just this being in the news is enough to, you know, frighten some people, even though they couldn't take that much legal action. But, but still, it does make me think that if someone wanted to do the same, like they could just do the same exact thing and it wouldn't matter.
Right.
So that's what's a little weird about the whole thing. I also wonder if there would have been more of an uproar if Cryptozoic didn't agree to cover all the copies, because then people just wouldn't get them at all. And I wonder, I feel like if Cryptozoic, because they did this, it made Kickstarter safer for the people that would have been naysayers otherwise. They're like, well, situation was bad, but it wasn't so bad. So I guess I'll keep backing things.
Well, Cryptozoic has kind of a vested interest in keeping the reputation of Kickstarter up, right? I mean, they run campaigns, right? They have Hex and they have maybe some other ones. So,
true.
Jamie, what do you think about this?
Oh, I agree with Andrew. I mean, it's really unfortunate. And I think the saddest thing to me is how far out of the way this guy went to mislead people.
Right.
Because I remember his original update when it came out, and he said, you know, this isn't going to happen. The money has been spent. And it sounded like a moment of truth where it sounded like he was telling the truth at that point. But what the FTC learned is that, allegedly, and I don't know how for sure we can say this, but it seemed to be that they learned that the guy never actually paid any of the artists anything. Like, he didn't use any of the money for the campaign at all. Mm-hmm. And so he was misleading everyone throughout the process, which I think, if there was maybe a little bit bigger of a punishment, it would discourage other creators from doing the same thing. But as it stands, if there's a creator who really wants to mislead people in the same way, they could probably get away with it, unfortunately.
Right. Well, there's another case that's going on now, Asylum Playing Cards. Are you familiar with this one? Washington State has actually sued the creator of this Kickstarter, who was protected from, you know, protected with an LLC, but they're suing him individually for, you know, under a consumer protection law. So it's actually, it would be a civil judgment. I don't know if it's a criminal thing, but, you know, so it's not the only, this isn't the only government action against that. I wonder if it becomes, and actually I'm not familiar with criminal law, so I don't know if the consumer protection laws can have criminal consequences, like he could go to prison or serve some other sort of sentence due to that. But I'll be interested in see how that goes as well.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, well, let's go on to our Q&A section. So these are pulled from the Board Game Geek Guild, the Dice Tower Guild, because I had asked for questions for this my Dice Tower segment, but we're going to transition them into here. So the first question comes from Peter Elsenheimer. What is the process a designer should go through to make sure that a game design's name, mechanisms, text, and art don't infringe on already established copyright or trademark nationwide or worldwide? Also, when in the design process should this inquiry be made? I'm curious what you two guys have to say about, you know, this kind of thing. Do you do any kind of checking on, you know, as far as trademark and copyright go? Or, you know, I have my own opinions on this and when in the process it should be done, but I'm wondering what you guys have done in the past.
Jamie, you want to go for it?
Sure. Yeah. So he listed a few things. He listed the name, mechanisms, text, and art. Mm-hmm. And the only one that I am ever really concerned about is the name. Mm-hmm. And I do a Board Game Geek search for it. I do a trademark search for the name, because everything else can't really be trademarked or copyrighted unless, to my knowledge, and Zach, you can speak to that.
Okay.
But, well, actually, specifically the mechanisms, the right. text and art, obviously, like, I don't use art that another game has used, and I don't copy and paste text that another game has used. With the mechanisms, the only risk that I see is if someone, and Zach, you've talked about this on your blog in the past, if someone takes an exact copy of a game and just puts new art on the same game right. and claims it as their own. But that's never even occurred to me to do, and I doubt that occurs to most people to do.
Right. Well, as long as you're not, you know, just outright stealing the game. I mean,
exactly.
You know, you've designed games yourself, and you've sort of worked with other designers. I guess you sort of have to, you know, watch your back a little bit when you're working with other people. If you are doing the design yourself, you know what you're doing. And, you know, I've seen a lot of posts on Board Game Geek about, you know, how much do I have to change in the game to make it legal? And my answer to that is like, you know, you're basically looking to rip it off, you know, by wondering what the bare minimum you have to change is. Why don't you, you know, just make your own thing? I don't know. I know that there are mechanisms that are, you know, in every game. And, you know, it's possible to make a game that's exactly the same, even if you're not, you know, trying to do it. But, you know, you have to make a concerted effort, I think, as a designer to, you know, differentiate your game. It's both good for business and it's good for keeping you out of any legal trouble, right? If you're right. just copying another game, you know, you're going to get a bad reputation in the industry and people aren't going to like you. Andrew, have you ever had concerns about any of this?
I mean, I'm kind of on the same page as what Jamie said, that really the name is the most important thing, and it's very easy to just look around for upfront, and you're kind of just do some deep Googling, look on Board Game Geek, et cetera. Obviously, yeah, you're not gonna try to copy any text or art unless the artist is somehow playing a trick on you and like reusing their assets, but mm-hmm. which would just be dumb because people are gonna see that in another game and get it right away. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, the name is the main thing. And as far as, I mean, the second part was kind of like, when in design process should the inquiry be made?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like once you're at the point where you pretty much know what your game is in terms of mechanics, maybe you haven't settled on all the content, you're still tweaking things, but that you'll have some names in mind. You can just sort of start looking around. You kind of just want to do it before you start making assets for the game. So it's well before you're going to release it or anything like that, or even, you know, get it onto Kickstarter if we're talking about crowdfunding.
Right. So. And so my answers to these two things would be, well, first of all, with trademark or with the name of the game and trademark, I think that's definitely something you want to do very early. You know, you don't want to start building goodwill for your game and you have a name that's sort of already been taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you're wasting time, you know, building this, establishing this brand where you could have been doing it in something that's actually going to stick with the game. And plus, you know, I wrote that other post on Jamie's site about getting the cease and desist letter, and that's something no one ever wants to get. You know, right. It can stall your campaign. It can make, you know, it's a hit to your morale too when you think that now I have this big legal problem going on. As far as, mechanisms and text and art, well, one thing you can do is it sort of protects you. I mean, realistically, it may not. When you have an artist making art for you, you know, when you have a contract with them, and in that contract, they have a warranty that they own the rights to this art and that they've created it and it's not copied from anyone else. Now, that may give you, so let's say you get sued or something happens. Well, then you can then sue them for breach of contract. You know, whether they, you know, if it's a small time artist, they're probably not going to have money to cover the amount of your lawsuit, but it's something. So one of those things where, yes, legally it protects you, but in the real world, it may not actually protect you at all. The last thing would be, yeah, the mechanisms and the text in the art. I think that being open with your game design, either you have sort of a print and play version or you know, have videos out there and you can sort of crowdsource this thing. You know, no designer knows every game that's out there, but, you know, the wisdom of the crowd can actually help, right? I don't know how protective people are, you know, it seems the secrecy doesn't really get you anything. If you put your game ideas out there and how your mechanics work, yes, somebody could steal it. But then again, it runs into the whole reputational factor. And if they really want to do that and they're going to be jerks, I mean, do you think that's a real concern with having your ideas out there, Jamie or Andrew?
No, I've never run into that issue of like, I generally think that by getting your ideas out there, like you said, you expose them to people so that they can either point out that if you've accidentally copied something verbatim, or they can point out in the future that someone else has then copied the thing that you put out in advance.
Right.
It's a safeguard to me.
I agree. Andrew, do you?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny but great feature of the game industry is that people are willing to do that. And like you said, it's all based on reputation. So if you're found to be copying someone else verbatim, then it's just terrible for you. I mean, you still might be able to capitalize on it, but probably not in the long run.
Right.
So yeah, I think that makes sense. And just, yeah, in terms of trademark and establishing yourself and all that, it's like you can just show, yeah, I had it first because it was way long ago when it was still in prototype form 2 years ago. And yeah, you can use it to start establishing your name if you know that, you know, no one else is using it, things like that. So yeah, it's definitely good. But I was going to say there's kind of a factor to it too, which is kind of funny that there's always been this thing in the world where based on the time in history that people will be kind of inventing the same thing at different parts in the world just because of where the collective conscious is at the time. And this is the same thing in the game industry that like there are just certain themes and certain mechanics that people are making because they're responding to things that are out there already. It's kind of like any other art form, right? And so I do find that even though people, they might not copy other people on purpose, but I noticed that like tons of people just come up with the same mechanics at the same time. Or like right now, there seems to be a lot of interest in time travel games, for instance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it kind of just happens anyway.
Right. And I think if you're, you know, copyright law does allow for something called independent creation, right? If you didn't have access to the other person's game and you created an exact copy, even if it's substantially similar to the other one, you know, it happens. It's not infringing. As opposed to something like trademark, where you don't have an excuse for not knowing about it. So,
right. So in that case, it's even more important to just get the word out so that way everyone does know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Next question. I recently was asked on the Secret Cabal Forum, right? I just recently asked on the Secret Cabal Forum what the basics of print and play and licensing were. This is from Brian Laylas. This was also on Board Game Geek. They mentioned a game called Dune the Dice Game, getting around the license by being a free and non-commercial game. I was wondering if that's true. Well, I mean, it may be true that if you are truly non-commercial, using another company's trademarks is okay. However, like if you even, let's say you're offering the print and play version of Dune, a Dune game, right? And you're using someone else's trademark. Even if you're using it on a totally, you know, you're giving it away free, but you have an ad on your site or you link to something like an affiliate link or something like that, it could be seen as commercial. But different courts have different ideas about what makes something commercial. So for instance, you can have like a site that says, I don't know, StonemaierGamesSucks.com, right? And as long as you're using their trademark, but if it's not commercial and it's a gripe site, you know, that's usually pretty perfectly legal. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of these sites have advertisement and things like that, and so it could be a commercial use. So even if you're giving it away free, there may be some commercial things going on, which may take it out of that. Beyond that, I think it's just not a good idea, you know, using someone else's intellectual property. I mean, yeah, it's great, you know, because, but you're basically, you're doing some shady things. You're taking advantage of the goodwill of Dune or, you know, whatever. And you're bringing a possible lawsuit against you or takedown letters or anything like that. And it's just trouble you don't need. You know, little guys sort of standing up to the big guys, it usually doesn't end well. That's the problem. Any thoughts on either?
Totally agree. Yeah, it just seems like a terrible idea legally.
Right.
Yeah.
We have something happening right now. I'm not sure how big of a deal it will end up being, but there's a site in China called Taobao.com. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about the site because it's all in Chinese, but one of our Chinese retailers pointed it out to me. And currently there is someone selling Between Two Cities on the site. As they're selling the print and play for it. Hmm. And obviously they don't have my permission to do that.
Right.
But it's, I've kind of been, so it's a little different than what you're saying. They're not giving it away for free. They're selling it, but
right.
Been trying to figure out.
That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know a huge amount of how to get things taken down in China, but
yeah, exactly.
It may be possible. There may be a way to do it. That's one of those things where I tell you to contact a Chinese lawyer and have them take care of it. If anything, I mean, I think China is starting to be more receptive to protecting intellectual property, but I mean, it's pretty much known as sort of a hotbed of, you know, piracy. So
yeah,
I mean, when I was there, we were watching TV shows, American TV shows on some website, and that's just sort of, I was told it was legal, but I have my doubts. So who knows? All right, let's get on to our main discussion topic. So we're going to talk today about raising money on Kickstarter. Hopefully we'll touch on some business and legal issues that are around it. But first, I'd like to hear both of you talk about your experience with using Kickstarter, because you've both done multiple campaigns. Is it a great thing or the greatest thing? Tell me. I love Kickstarter. I'm an unabashed Kickstarter fan, and I'm sure both of you are as well. I know there's a lot of people that are very down on it, but I think we've gathered a sort of brain trust of people who love Kickstarter. So, Jamie, why don't you start?
Sure, yeah. I thought this is an interesting way of phrasing it, because when I think about Kickstarter, I definitely, the money is part of it, but it's also a huge part of it is about building community, making something better together with people. But you phrase it that way, so I figured you wanted to focus specifically on the monetary side of it. From my experience, it's been pretty necessary, really, the money to raise funds on Kickstarter to launch new products. Mm-hmm. It's kind of I've used it to launch a new version of all of our games. What I don't use it for is for multiple print runs, like the second or third print run of a game. I think different publishers have different philosophies about that. But for me, it's kind of, I use it as a way to create something new. Mm-hmm. And like Andrew said earlier, to find out if there's interest in it, to gauge the temperature, then use the money to actually produce the first print run. And I usually produce a print run that accounts for all the backer copies, all the backer rewards, but also leaves room for retail sales. And it's from that money that I then have more money to do a second print run if I want to. So far, I've had a positive experience with that.
Now, you're talking about companies that would start a new Kickstarter to do a second print run, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what Jamie just said. Like, I'm very positive on it. I'm kind of where Jamie is with just sort of my philosophy on it, but and I sort of feel like there are many people that way, because Jamie has been able to establish this kind of, I mean, one, just how to operate and really the base for everything, and what is a great place to start for every campaign, with all his blog posts and everything. So thank you, Jamie, for doing that for everyone. But yeah, it's just like, for the companies in the case where they're doing a second print run, I'm not personally so against it. I don't know that I would do it, but it seems okay as long as people are into it, because it's a way for them to get money again. And who's to say that they are really, like you're saying, like Jamie said, you might use typically the money from the Kickstarter to fulfill the backer rewards and then make some other copies to sell at retail. But what if they want to use those other retail copies, you know, the profit from those to use towards some other game. And you'd be getting a second Kickstarter on the print run. Like that, it just makes sense because people generally don't, they're not comfortable with you using funds for other things than the thing that you're making. So that's why that seemed acceptable to me. But just, I mean, I know that that's not really the topic, kind of just a tangent, but
no, well actually,
yeah, I'm very positive. Yeah.
That was kind of one of my questions that I had later in the list. You know, how do you feel about project creators using the Kickstarter money for other things? You know, I remember when, so there's that Exploding Kittens game that raised $8-some million. I don't know if you're probably familiar with that one.
Yeah.
You know, the question then becomes, okay, so these, you know, what do they do with all this extra money? Obviously, their costs are not going to be $8 million. So what do you do with that extra money? And I, you know, I read gaming forums and people are genuinely curious. And, you know, the obvious answer to me is, you know, you keep it or you put it into your business or something like that. You know, you are taking the money. You know, you've promised certain rewards. As long as you fulfill those rewards, you really have no responsibility, you know, maybe at least legally, to do anything else with the money. As long as you're fulfilling, you know, what you've promised. You know, do you think that that's sort of an unethical way to look at it? Or do you think that's going against the spirit of Kickstarter? Should you be pouring all that extra money into the project? I mean, I'm not really sure what else they could do on something like that, that, you know, give you another game or something like that. But, you know, in on the Shenmue Kickstarter, you know, if they raise extra money, you know, does, obviously people, you know, they put stretch goals in there, but do they have to put all of those millions into the game? Or is now their company has made profit and you've used, you know, you've made your Kickstarter into sort of a profit making machine. How do you guys feel about that?
I feel like as long as you can use, as long as you fulfill everything for backers, all the backer rewards, then I feel like you can use the money for whatever else you want. Mm-hmm. Generally, I do think that people should use it for their business and like use it to keep developing new products and things like that. But, I mean, as a creator, I definitely think that, that people should be able to take some of the money after they've fulfilled everything for backers, and just act as if it is profit and, you know, possibly pay themselves with it because, I know for me, like I'm trying to just make this my full-time thing. And so to do that, I need to like pay for food and pay for rent and stuff like that. Yeah. And as long as you're not doing like the, you know, doing the Came to Atlantic City thing where you're just doing, where you're paying for those things before fulfilling backer rewards, then I think that you're okay. But I am curious to see what you think of this, Jamie, because you are at a point now where you've been able to consistently make money from these things and, you know, really build a business out of it.
Yeah, well, and also I should say that like my philosophies about this kind of stuff, they change over time, and I'm not trying to impose them on anybody else. But like basically the way my company works is that I'll raise the money on Kickstarter, and I use the vast majority of that money for the print run and for shipping. Like I produce a lot of games in that first print run, and then. So I kind of hold off any true profit from it until we sell the retail copies. Sure. But I don't think there was a point in time a couple of years ago when I thought, okay, you shouldn't be like making profit on the Kickstarter. But I no longer really feel that way. Like if I wanted, with Between Two Cities, if I wanted to make exactly enough games to send out backer rewards and then use the rest to give to the designers and keep for myself to run the company, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean,
I agree. Yeah. I think this is a perfect way. Yeah, I think there's an attitude, and especially given the sort of founding principles of Kickstarter, you know, it's grown into something else. Like you say, you know, it's sort of grown along with your philosophy, Jamie. It's gone from, you know, these are creative projects that never would have happened in the first place to sort of, you know, the way it is now. I mean, to deny that it's either a pre-order system or a way for businesses to grow their businesses. Yeah, it's both. You know, it's for the person who's never done anything before and they really just have a, you know, this creative spark that they want to get out there. But it, you know, it's also a very convenient way for businesses to raise money and, you know, like gauge the desire for that product. I don't have any philosophical, you know, disagreement with that. I think it's fine. And the best part about it is that big companies come in, and I think I've heard you discuss this on other podcasts, Jamie, you know, big companies come in and they actually bring attention to Kickstarter as a thing which mm-hmm. then leads to discovery of other projects, which I think is good. You know, so smaller projects may get discovered. I mean, discovery on Kickstarter is not great, but right. still, it's more exposure that I think is it's not a, it can't be a bad thing, right? I don't think the big right. projects are drowning out the little projects. I think the little projects are not, you know, they're not doing their own community building, which is why they should read your Kickstarter lessons from number one and, you know, read them all.
I think, Zach, if you don't mind, can I back up to something Andrew said before?
Absolutely.
That I think is interesting? The idea, and it kind of ties into what you just said, too, about using Kickstarter or crowdfunding for the second or third print run, mm-hmm. or in some, I think, like Alien Frontiers, they've had the fourth or fifth print run on Kickstarter. The only danger that I think is there is that you may start to lose retailer support in general.
Right.
If retailers consistently see your company just returning to Kickstarter for those print runs, and because I think that's when it does start to hurt retailers a little bit. I don't think the first Kickstarter for a game ever really hurts retailers. If anything, it helps draw attention to a game.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, and I think maybe that depends on the company by company basis. And for me, my relationship with distributors and retailers is really important if I want to make this company grow and if I want to continue to have my income come from this company. So I think that's mainly where I'm coming from with that philosophy.
Yeah, I guess my question was, while you were saying that and you kind of answered it, should you care? Is it important to have those good relationships with retailers? And I guess, like you said, you know, if you want to have an ongoing business where your game is always in supply, then yes, having retailers and distributors have your back is definitely important. But if you're just a small creator and you just want to get that one game out there, well, you may not get funded because you're not really putting in that work. But I think it's maybe not as important if retailers right. don't care about it anyway. Right. Okay. So this is sort of from the backer's side. So since we've seen there's really realistically no way for backers to get their money back after a project fails, as we've seen with Doom that came to Atlantic City, and we've seen with some other ones. Is there anything a backer should do? Is there nothing? Should they just forget it? Andrew, what do you think?
I mean, it's a great question. Yeah, there's not a ton of protection for people. And I also don't think that Kickstarter should have to do that, which maybe sounds bad, but they're kind of just providing a platform. And
right.
if they did do that, then it would be just a giant headache for them. And that would become kind of the thing that they do, is make sure that backers get their products. And like they already do this. They try and I actually was just talking to my friend who works at Kickstarter the other day. And he said that, you know, this is a big thing that they have to try and do is like really grease the relationship between the creators and the backers and make sure everyone's getting what they can and make sure that the creators are providing updates to people and just, you know, communication is really clear. But, yeah, I don't know. I do feel like there's going to be something that happens in the future where there's maybe some website that people can go to where that's just based around, you know, getting something from these Kickstarters that don't pan out or aren't as like something that we haven't talked about is like where a Kickstarter that delivers a product, but is just really low quality.
Right.
I mean, in that case, are they justified at all in trying to get something more from the situation, or should they just be disappointed and never buy from that person again?
I mean,
like, that's kind of a lot of questions around that.
I have kind of maybe a libertarian attitude about this, you know, where I don't think Kickstarter, yes, they're just matching you up. And I think people, you know, people are adults. You have to be an adult to pledge on Kickstarter. So I think, you know, you have to be smart with your money and you have to realize, you know, if it's a first time developer, well, you know, maybe you should take some caution and you shouldn't put $150 into that game or if they have no track record, you know, ultimately it's on you. Yes, there's legal consequences, but as I've said before, you know, there really isn't. So you have to be smart about it and you have to understand the risk. And I liken it to going into a casino. You know, you only walk in with as much money as you want to lose or you can afford to lose, right? So don't put your whole paycheck on a Kickstarter project. That's a bad idea. And you should probably know that. I know that you love the watch or, you know, that ridiculous cooler that was on there, but you shouldn't be spending more money than you have on it. It's just not a good idea.
Right. And like casinos, like they can't tell you up front, like, hey, this is super, super risky.
Right.
Like, be careful because then no one's going to use them. Right.
Right. Exactly. Well, and I don't think Kickstarter necessarily has the responsibility to do that. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Jamie, do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, I was really, me and probably the listeners are probably the most interested about your answer from your legal background. Like, have you ever backed a project where you considered, like, even though you did your due diligence, that you did, if you didn't get it, did you ever think, you know, I need to act in some way?
I generally, well, because I'm sort of a nomad, I don't have a home where I can keep large games. All my boxed games are at a friend's house. So I don't generally buy or kickstart big board games. So I've only done small ones and, you know, $10 to $15 projects. And I don't, you know, after I back them, I don't actually even follow them very much. It's funny. You know, if I get the game, okay. If not, I lost $10 or $15. I'm sort of a casual backer, I guess. I'm not one that's very invested in. And that may change when something amazing comes out and I really want it. But, you know, I've sort of taken the attitude that if it doesn't come out, then I'm okay. And I'm not going to put in more than, you know, it wouldn't be offensive to me if they did it. But again, if they failed to fulfill the reward, I definitely wouldn't back with them again.
Yeah, I can think of, I kind of take the same approach where I'm sure that I have projects right now that I should have received a long time ago that I just haven't received, and maybe I'll never receive. I don't even think about it.
Right.
There's only one instance where I can remember getting mad about it, and it was when it was like a literary magazine that I backed, and I followed the updates. I was into it. I was excited about it. And the update started talking about how they had released it to retailers and how they were going to then ship to backers in a few months after.
Right.
And they were very public. I mean, it's really like they didn't even realize what they were doing by doing that. But that was the one instance where I was like, okay, I would never support them again after doing that.
Right. And it's funny because, I mean, you're still going to get your thing. You're still going to get the product, but still that's the sort of, you know, slap to the face that I mean, in those things, you as the creator, you really have to make it clear that the backers are the reason for it even existing. So you really need to treat them, I think, as customer number one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. So the other question I have is the bar has been raised on many of these projects lately. I've seen lots with high production values, amazing artwork, selling their game on the Kickstarter campaign page. So what do you do? Well, I mean, Andrew, your video is awesome. Maybe we should start with you. I mean, what does someone do if they don't have the money to have, you know, an awesome video with people with costumes and, you know, all that stuff? You know, how do you effectively sell your game? If you don't have any artwork, you know, you don't have all that.
Yeah,
maybe I mean, ask you, how did you get the quality of your campaign page up that high?
I mean, it was kind of a mix. So, yes, I did pay to have my video done. I have a friend that's a filmmaker here in LA, and he's awesome. So I paid him, and that made sense. And I mean, there's other stuff like all the art for the game I had to pay for beforehand. And then like my graphic designer actually worked for free, which I am very, very happy about. Like all the stuff on the Kickstarter page was really, you know, his doing and kind of my art direction with that. But if you don't have the funds to do this kind of stuff, I mean, I kind of liken it to the App Store and what has happened with that over time, where it's really advertising dollars that rule the Apple App Store. And if you want to get anywhere with that, you kind of have to be able to build up an audience for a long time beforehand, which I would say is the same thing with Kickstarter. Like you can kind of just do like boots on ground convention work, or even just like very cheap local conventions to just try and build up sort of a groundswell over time. And also just do things that other people aren't doing, like try and do different strategies for your Kickstarter page, like just sort of creative ways to improve upon the project or get the community involved and sort of stand out in news stories, or just go with like a really different aesthetic. Like I noticed a lot of indie games on the App Store will have just really interesting, like whether it's cel-shaded graphics, or like some kind of weird futuristic space thing that I saw recently. Like just do something to separate yourself from everyone else. Otherwise you are going to be competing in that ring. But at a minimum, I feel like you do have to have some art pieces done just to show what your aesthetic is, no matter who's doing them. But what do you think, Jamie?
Well, yeah, I'm looking at, I've talked about your Kickstarter page on my blog. I've said that it's one of the most, and really I mean this, it's one of the most perfect project pages I've ever seen. And I'm trying to think if someone could have put together this page without paying much up front. You said your graphic designer worked for free, so that certainly helps quite a bit. I do think, like, looking at, I'm like literally scrolling down your page right now. A person who doesn't have a lot of money to spend up front could probably purchase like five really beautiful pieces of art from an artist,
right?
And probably get by. Like, they could have done maybe one or two sample cards, a few of the key graphics, the potion cards that you have, and then maybe the box art. I think the box art is really important. And they probably could have launched that. They would have had to put a delivery date well beyond what you put, because they have to do all that art on the back end instead of up front.
Right.
Sure.
But I think it is possible. But you still need something. You need to give people a visual sense of the game or whatever the product is.
Right, right. And I was going to mention with that the graphic designer worked for free, and that was great. But, I mean, the only reason I met him was because I was at a convention, and we established a relationship, became friends, and he really liked the game and just wanted to be a part of the project.
Right.
So, again, that's one of those advantages of Dill, just like getting out there and networking, seeing if people are interested, and maybe they'll join your team. And, I mean, normally artists don't like this, but, you know, getting some percentage after the Kickstarter from whatever is made.
Right. But if they believe in the game, like you say, then generally they may be willing to do that. I mean, like everybody, they have to eat, right?
Right.
But, you know, if it's just a side project for everyone and you're really partnering up, it's not just, you know, this guy's doing some art for me. It's like, no, we're partners, you know, this, because he's a great artist and he has a lot of value they can give to the company. I mean, not every artist is going to do that, but if you really become, you have to think of it like you're on the same level. Right. If you're the designer, they're the artist, and then you have a graphic designer and you're all working together, or maybe you have a business guy or something like that, you know, to really make it work. But, you know, the other thing is, you know, sometimes, you know, to make something work, you have to put in some money. That's just the way it is. Right. That's how business works. Yeah. You have to take a little risk on your side, you know, and if you believe in a project, you know, you have to kind of put your money where your mouth is. Another way to do it, and actually I'm going to have another episode where we specifically talk about this, as other ways to raise money. You know, if you need $10,000 before you actually run your campaign, well, maybe you know, to get the high quality art, you know, maybe you can raise it from family and friends and from other sort of small investors. If you can get $500 from 20 people, you know, not everyone knows a bunch of people like that, but
yeah,
it's not impossible. And I've seen people do it, and there may be some, you know, you could either take loans or you know, you can give them some sort of royalties, but that involves some other legal issues. So yes, ask a lawyer before you do any of that stuff, you know, but it's possible. I don't know. I think it's one of those things where if you're not ready to commit to that, then maybe you shouldn't be committing to taking, you know, $10,000 of other people's money on a Kickstarter, or 20,000, or however much you're going to take. Maybe you need to just be working in the print and play space for a little while, or working for someone else until you get to that point in your business where you're ready to act like a business and really start working with big money.
Right. There is a project. Go ahead, Zach.
Well, I just think that, you know, it's one of those things where, yes, the idea of Kickstarter was to start these things, but I think many of the failures and the bad stories about Kickstarter come from people who are getting in way over their heads and don't understand the business side of things. So you need to learn that business side, or find someone to work with that knows about that, you know?
Totally.
Yeah, I think sometimes from those failures, the example I was going to give is there's a project called The King's Armory by John Rott. That didn't successfully fund a few summers ago on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons John found out was the art. He thought he had good art, but then people told him that he didn't. And so he went back, and before he relaunched, he ran a small Indiegogo campaign just for the art so that he could have better art to feature.
Right.
And so it kind of speaks to the model you talked about maybe just raising money. Mm-hmm. so that your project and your game or your product looks good. And it worked for John, and he ended up then successfully way over funding after that.
Sometimes you need to be as creative in getting the project started as you are in creating the project itself, right?
Right.
You need it's just the way it is, you know? You need to think outside the box sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well put.
Yeah. Okay, another question. So do you think that for developers, especially new developers, this is the best way to raise money for your game development? Jamie?
It's tough to say if it's the best way. I love it because it's, like I said, it's not just about the money to me, and I think to a lot of other creators. I mean, again, we're talking about Apotheca here today. Andrew has a lot of comments. People are engaging in the campaign quite a bit. Right. And he's building the excitement for it. So when the game finally comes out, people are probably going to play it right away because they've been excited about it for a couple months. And I think that's great. I there aren't a lot of other platforms that do that. I could probably raise money from investors to make a new game, but it's so behind the scenes. No one would really see much about it except for what I talk about on my website and newsletter. I don't know. Andrew, what do you think? I mean, would you, if you had an investor come to you today and say, I want you to cancel your campaign, I'm just going to give you $150,000 to make this game, I think we'll do great with it. What would you do?
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. I mean, even though it sounds kind of ridiculous, but it is so much about like exposure and community and building buzz and all these kind of they seem like fringe benefits to Kickstarter, but they're actually like really important. So I agree on that front. Like getting back to the original question, like I do think it's great for new creators, and I think this is the best way to do it, especially for game projects, because they do so well on there if you're, you know, well prepared and you put everything into motion that needs to be there. So yeah, I think it's awesome.
Do you think there's too many games on there? Do you think it's become too big where now it's just difficult for a new developer to
not yet. I do think it's going to get saturated, like maybe in a year, but it really is following the whole model of the App Store, which that is just insane now. But and that's because there's so much revenue potential there. It's less so with Kickstarter, especially with board games, because you have to spend so much money on you know, actually manufacturing and shipping, like Jamie was saying before. But I think it's still doable for new people to get up there as long as they are just well prepared.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing either. If there's a lot of things, if there's a lot of choices, A, that's a good thing. And B, it also forces you to really put in the work and, you know, make something that actually is creative, right? If there was two board games on there, they could be anything and people would probably back them just because they want board games. But since there's a million board games, you know, you really have to set yourself apart, and it forces people to think creatively, design creatively, and really, you know, set themselves apart from the rest of the crowd.
Right. Yeah. I think right now there are like 250 some board game projects on Kickstarter, and a lot of them, I would say maybe 20% of them set them apart from the rest of the crowd, and the rest will fade away. And that's okay. That's what Kickstarter is all about, determining the demand for your product.
Right. Well, 80 to 90% of everything is crap. I mean, it's just sort of the general rule, but it's true, you know?
Yeah. Did you get that from StoneMeyerSocks.com?
80% of everything StoneMeyer releases is crap. Yes.
Yeah.
That's like most of our, that's all of our products. We only have four products.
That new treasure chest is good. That's about it, I think. I'm just kidding, of course. They're all amazing. Okay. So you would recommend this, this sort of career that you guys are doing, is this something you would recommend to other people? I mean, designing board games, running Kickstarters, doing all that, is, do you have fun? Do you love it? I think that's the important
Jamie?
Thing.
That's a good question. I'm curious about your answer, Andrew, because you're in the middle of it right now. Are you having fun every day, every moment of every day during the campaign?
I mean, it's a challenge every day, especially with, like you were saying, everyone commenting. It's tough because just every single little part of the project, someone really loves and someone really hates for whatever reason.
Right.
So there's so much like PR, just community management in there, where you're kind of, you have to listen to people, and you want to, right? You want to make your product the best that it can be. You want people to be happy and for everyone to be involved. But at the same time, you don't want them to derail you, because if they keep requesting these different things and you keep looking into them, it's going to cost you too much money, and then you're actually not going to make anything, and you could actually lose money from the Kickstarter. So it's really risky. But in general, just getting back to the main point, you have to have a very vast skill set to get into this whole thing. And it's yeah, I would recommend it to other people, but only if you have this skill set. But unfortunately, you're not really going to know what you need to do until you do it all, and then you realize how overwhelming it can be and what you need to do to get that all done. But like for me, it definitely helped to have experience in just a lot of different things. So of course, like game design and working with teams in video games, but also like monetization that I was doing on mobile games and just those sorts of things. But
right.
I don't know. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, yeah, kind of to piggyback off of that, I think for anyone, whether someone succeeds or fails in funding their campaign, it's an incredible learning experience about working with a lot of people who are passionate about your project, whether or not they do end up derailing you or if they're really enthusiastic about everything you say. It's like I've just learned so much from the people interactions on the project, not to mention all the stuff like the product management side of it. So yeah, Zach, I think you originally asked, would we recommend it to other people? Mm-hmm. And I would, if not just for that learning experience.
Right. But you know, in my opinion, yeah, you have to be prepared to deal with all of the, you know, it's an octopus, right? You have to deal with mm-hmm. all these different legs, these different aspects. You know, I'm the same way. I started out as nobody and I came on the internet and, you know, you have to put in work, you know, you have to write 150 articles that, you know, actually educate people and you have to provide value to people. You have to go on podcasts. You have to start your own podcast. You know, you have to start your blog. You have to put in work. You can't just expect. And I think maybe earlier in Kickstarter, it was easier. And I know you talk about this on your blog all the time, Jamie. You know, you have to build your community. I think mm-hmm. that's the most important thing. And you have to go from zero to somebody people should care about. And whether that's just because you have an amazing idea or because you've provided value to the game design community or any of those things, you know, you have to build a fan base. You know, it's just,
right.
I mean, it's just business 101. And any business has to go through it. Whether it's a local mom and pop business, you have to advertise, or it's something on the internet, like my business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. And like we were talking before about kind of exposing your game the earliest that you can and sort of establishing that it was there first. It's the same. You get other benefits from that as well. Like you just, in order to build the fan base, people need to be seeing your game well, well in advance. And right. you can't just... I mean, I know I thought about doing the whole board game company thing a long time ago, and like since then, that's why I started building up my Twitter fan base very early on to do that. And
right.
yeah, I think like if you're thinking about this at all, then yeah, just spend an hour a day doing it, whatever you can do.
Right. I mean, you have to be interesting to have people notice you. Your game has to be interesting. The things you say have to be interesting. If you can't meet that sort of basic requirement, then why should anyone care, I guess, is the lesson I've taken from it. You know, you have to, and maybe that's not inclusive of everyone, but I mean, everyone, you, in the end, you're taking people's money in exchange for a product. So you have to provide them value. I just think, and this is maybe one of the other show topics I'm going to do is, you know, how to act like a business when you actually are getting into business and how important that is. So,
yeah, that's a great topic.
All right. Well, guys, I appreciate you both coming in. That was amazing. This is a great first episode. I'm very excited about the future and I'd love to have both of you on. Jamie, where can people find you?
Yeah, people can find me at, I'm on Twitter at Jamie Stegmeier and at Stonemeyer Games. I'm on Facebook at Stonemeyer Games. And probably the easiest way to find me and remember is my website, kickstarterlessons.com.
Right. That's great. Okay, Andrew, where can people find you?
You can go to knapsackgames.com. And like Jamie, I have twitter.com/knapsackgames, facebook.com/knapsackgames. And we are on Kickstarter, the game Apotheca. You can just search for that there. Or you can go to bit.ly/apotheca, and that will point you to the page.
Awesome. Well, and you can find me, streebecklaw.com. Actually, what is it? I started a new one that redirects. I think it's gamelawyerblog.com. We'll take you to my blog where I talk about game topics. Legalmovespodcast.com will bring you to the site where other episodes of this podcast hopefully will be up soon. And if you have any questions, please send them in. There's actually a contact form on the legalmovespodcast.com site. So I'd love to answer your questions about the game business, anything. So until next time, thank you guys, and I will see you in the next episode.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It was great.
Yeah, thanks, Zach.